Welcome to the Performance Recipe Podcast with me, Richard Stewart, a performance nutritionist and personal trainer. We all know we can get tangled amongst the facts and fads on social media, and so the purpose of this podcast is to bridge the gap between science and practice by having industry experts on all topics performance related. I became a performance nutritionist because of my background in Michelin star restaurants and being a personal trainer, bridging the gap between food and fitness. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Welcome to episode 9 of the Performance Recipe Podcast. Next up, we have world-renowned coach, Borghi Fageli, the mastermind behind the Maya Reps model. Borghi introduced himself as a 50-year-old peak performance coach from Norway with nearly 30 years of experience working with over 6,000 clients across different sports and fitness levels. His aims to approach training objectively, avoiding dogmatic stances, and instead seeking to understand different perspectives to improve outcomes for his clients. Morning. Thank you so much for joining me on the Performance Recipe Podcast. So today we've got one of the best in the industry, someone who I've always inspired to be like and one always followed, specifically because one of the only coaches in the world where, in my opinion, looks at the science and the practice and genuinely puts it together without having any sort of bias. In my opinion, you're always on the fence with things. There may be some bias there sometimes, but I do feel that you look at the science and you look at what coaches are giving out and you put it all together as opposed to just looking at one narrative and that's it. So if you could just introduce yourself and tell people a little bit about your background, that'd be amazing. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. That's a very nice introduction. I really appreciate it. I find it difficult to go along with being the best because, you know, I hate kind of the guru status. I think also we all have our own biases, and I have many, and I constantly try to be aware of them so that I don't run myself into a box or become labeled as, you know, the Maya Reps guy or you know, the high reps or the low reps or the low carb or high carb or whatever. So I'm 50 years old. I live in Norway. I have a wife and a 7-year-old son. I like to refer to myself as a peak performance coach. My program or community is called Peaceful Peak Performance. So I've spent a almost 30-year-long career working with, at last count, 5,000. I think we're getting closer to 6,000 now. People from all walks of life, all different levels, all different sports. I have perhaps spent more time in the physique sports since, you know, bodybuilding has been a passion of mine since I started watching Arnold Schwarzenegger movies, as everyone else probably did back in the 80s. And I guess you can say I've done it all. I worked with several coaches. I've collaborated with several high-end coaches and names and experts in the industry. I try to learn and discuss, and I prefer to, as much as possible, stay open to learning something that will improve results for everyone instead of just locking myself into this rigid dogmatic mindset that many seem to be chasing these days. And unfortunately, that seems to be what works. You need to be controversial. You need to take a strong stance on the subject, and I think the problem with that is that if your ego gets locked into a certain narrow-minded concept or brand or theory, then it's easier to fall into echo chambers and groupthink and pretty much ignore everything that contradicts your models of the world. So I want to... My mission is to improve our common understanding on how to become the best versions of ourselves. And I do believe we do that by having an open discourse, even engaging with people that disagree with us. Actually, I've used coaches that have opposite perspectives on training and nutrition as myself, simply because I want to learn. Excuse me. I want to learn why they think the way they do. So perhaps I can challenge my own beliefs and learn the contextual side of it, because it's like with everything else, it's contextual, it's individualized. And I think we need to spend more time to understand what works on an individual level. And I hope to, you know, be able to communicate that as objectively as possible in today's interview.
Amazing. Thank you so much. I have a very similar perspective on coaching, and that's why I started this Performance Recipe podcast. I've had physios that work with Team GB. I've had physiology experts come on. I've had creatine experts, etc. And you've got like a physiotherapist saying, don't go into the gym for the first time and increase your volume too quickly, because that's where an injury might happen. And you've got a body composition expert coming along saying, the more reps and more volume you essentially do, then potential for greater hypertrophy results. So obviously talking about different sets and rep ranges. And then the physiology guy coming along saying, like, you don't need as many reps, just focusing on your fatigue and tension. And and obviously it goes a lot more detailed than that. But it just, basically the idea is to have different perspectives from different groups of experts, and then putting it all together to figure out what works best for you. And I think you're the perfect person that I can get people to have an example of. So that's why I have you on, besides all the expertise that you do have. And I just understand that you will put everything into context, which is something I really appreciate. So there's a lot of debate at the moment when it comes to hypertrophy volume. And it's something that I'm a little bit confused about myself. And people say, what is the volume do you think is best for hypertrophy? And is adding a set automatically progressive overload? That's the first question.
Yeah, good question. it's not progressive overload per se, because, and again, you can't really overload anything. You can just load. And it's determined by the ultimate capacity, your present capacity of the muscle. And I guess a good way to frame this question is the same way you would ask, what's the best way to get a suntan? I tend to use the tanning analogy because it's the same physiological concept. You expose your skin to a certain intensity and duration of sunlight, and it will adapt by producing melanin so that your skin protects itself against further sun exposure in the future. And, you know, we can't just say that, you know, there's always going to be this perfect amount of sun exposure without first defining, you know, what's your sun exposure history? Where do you live in the world? How intense is the sun? What's the cloud cover? You know, what time of day is it? Is it the summertime? Is it the wintertime? So, you know, there will be such a wide range of individual response to a certain intensity and duration of sunlight that we can't ultimately predict this from formulas or just, you know, tell everyone, well, you know, you should be spending 20 minutes in the sun. Because if you're Nordic like me, you know, I do have a tan since it's been summer here, and I make sure to spend a lot of time in the sun. But, you know, take someone with the typical, you know, red complexion. They might even have red hair, and we know they are more sensitive to sunlight. And you tell them 20 minutes and they go to Spain and they spend 20 minutes in the middle of the day without sunscreen. I can guarantee you they will get the sunburn. Take someone living in Spain and tell them to spend 20 minutes and barely phases their skin. You know, it doesn't affect it. So we need to approach training from the same perspective. You know, what's your training history? What's your level of exposure to lifting weights? How strong are you? And to me, progression in, you know, stimulus, progression in load should be a consequence of your muscle becoming stronger and able to do that. So you can both say, you know, on the one hand, you have people chasing progression because progression is important to further stimulate muscle growth. But we also know that until your skin has the proper amount of tan, then you can just use the same amount and, you know, intensity and duration of sun exposure and still tan. So a certain load and volume can work for quite a while until the muscle has actually become stronger and bigger and able to lift the heavier load. Because if you then keep doing the same reps and even sets, then that will eventually fall below the threshold for a stimulus, and it's just a warm-up to you. So you need to do more reps with the same load, or you need to increment the load and do the same reps. That means that an adaptation has taken place, and essentially tells you that what you have been doing is working. So I don't really consider adding volume or adding reps. You know, I think adding reps just bring you closer to that muscle's current capacity to move a load. Because the primary stimulus for muscle growth is mechanical tension. And the mechanical tension needs to be close to the limit of that muscle. So we also need to apply effort. And effort is applied by lifting a sufficiently heavy load to the limit of the capacity of that muscle. So we need to train closer to failure. If you're just doing, you know, you can do a ton of sets at a warm-up load, and there will be some muscle growth if you just do a ton of sets, obviously. But one hard set already provides 50 to 80% of the stimulus, depending on the exercise, you know, how good your mind and muscle connection is, how good you are at applying that load to the tissue in question. So an isolation exercise for a beginner, one set. For a more advanced, I will even argue that one set will do the job if you're doing a bicep curl or leg extension to 50 to 80% of your maximum stimulus potential. Simply because you're more advanced, you're lifting heavier loads, you're better able to apply effort to that muscle and only that muscle, isolate that muscle. Whereas the more you distribute that stimulus among several different muscle groups, and you're doing like a squat or leg press, or, you know, your bicep will get stimulated from pull-ups, but you're also using your back muscles. So you kind of distribute the load, and then it doesn't really count as much stimulus-wise. So there are many contexts and things we need to take into consideration when we want to calculate how much stimulus have we applied to that muscle. So, you know, I guess that's a long way to answer a simple question, but these things are way more complex than social media make it seem as. So we can't just prescribe one set and say that this will provide X amount of stimulus, you know, arbitrary units of stimulus to that muscle, since there's so many variables involved.
Yeah, so is it right that when people are trying to grow, let's say, a specific muscle, try to isolate that muscle as much as possible, and then in the sense of maybe trying to reduce the amount of compensatory mechanisms? So like if you're doing a barbell back squat trying to grow your legs, do you think it's probably not as effective as, let's say, someone trying to grow their quads, and they go off and do a leg extension would probably be a better idea? just because of those compensatory mechanisms.
Yeah, I mean, a squat is more time efficient since you're loading more overall muscle mass. So, you know, with a squat, you can essentially, that's the combination of hip extension and knee extension, and you're also using core muscles and, you know, back muscles to support the weight. So it's more time efficient, but it's less targeted towards your quads. And I know plenty of, you know, 1,000-pound squatters, and they don't really have impressive quads at all. Until they start doing leg extensions, which isolate the muscle better. Because in any given movement, the brain will direct resources and neural impulses to the muscle group that it's, you know, determined to be more efficient at doing the job. And, you know, I used to be, you know, benching only to build my pecs and had no mass at all. It only grew my triceps simply because my triceps were dominating and overpowering all the other muscle groups in that movement. So as soon as I started adding in more flies, I just dropped bench completely because it just ruined my shoulders due to my long arms and narrow chest. Then now my pecs started growing again. And after a period of time, now when I go back to doing a bench press, I suddenly feel my pecs working. So sometimes you need to build that muscle up to a certain level before it actually contributes positively to that movement. And going back to the squat, I never got big quads from doing squats. I don't have the biomechanics or the structure, so I need more isolation work. And even just doing Smith squats for me, that takes the back out of the movement and allows me to put my feet in a position where I can actually target my quads better. And, you know, it's been a game changer for me. And, you know, most people know who Dorian Yates is, and he found the exact same thing. He started doing Smith squats and eventually moved to leg pressing only to build his enormous squats. So, we need to consider individual biomechanics and are you actually getting any growth out of that movement or are you just doing it because, you know, the bros told you to? So these things are important.
Yeah, because isn't it that when you're trying to grow a specific muscle, when you're trying to cause a contraction, it's a voluntary contraction, right? So if you're trying to contract a specific muscle that you're, let's say, like in squatting movement, is your quads you're trying to grow, let's say, hypothetically speaking, and all of a sudden you're having to focus on your balance and the contraction on your back, that is taking away from the cognitive side of things and actually reducing your that mind-to-muscle connection. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. The more resources you have to direct to stabilizing and, you know, just moving the load from A to B doesn't guarantee that you're actually working the muscle that you want to work if there are several muscles involved. So you have to, it's always the weak muscle group in that movement that will take charge and get the most stimulus. And, you know, the contributing muscle might not due to livers or biomechanics actually be the muscle that you want to build larger and stronger. So we need to be mindful of what exercises we use in our programs. Look at our own individual structure and biomechanics.
Awesome. So I've realized now, so speaking to like a physiology expert, and now listening to you, first set 50 to 80% stimulus, right? And then second set a little bit more, third set a little bit more. And then after that, most of the time it seems to plateau to an extent. I think that is correct. And then now recognizing that sort of volume, I'm just wondering now what matters more, being able to do more volume with more reps, more sets of in a certain exercise program. So let's say today someone decides to do, they know that 6 to 10 sets of chest is going to maximize hypertrophy, hypothetically speaking, for them. Is it better to do 3 exercises of 3 sets, or is it better to do 3 exercises of the chest, but over 3 days. So does volume and frequency matter, and which is superior?
Yeah, none of them are superior. It's an interaction. There's only so much you can do in a single bout until you reach an upper threshold where you're essentially just generating fatigue and not getting an extra stimulus. And I think most that have been doing research for a while can agree that we see the most benefits from the early sets, and that already provides the same. I like to use Dr. Samuel Buckner's analogy of cooking a pizza. You know, you need a certain time in the oven to actually cook the pizza. And if you just leave it in there, then you're going to burn it. You're not going to be able to, you know, eat it. But if you don't leave it in for sufficiently long, then you're going to be eating cold pizza. So there's always going to be this curve, and it varies. Like, you just define according to what exercise selection you have, how well that targets the muscle, how good you are at recruiting that muscle. Because, you know, the larger the muscle, the harder it is to recruit, which is generally why we can do more volume for legs, simply because, you know, it takes more to cook the pizza. And also the level of effort. So we can't really define volume without discussing proximity to failure. If you're lifting heavy loads, then we know that all reps are generally going to be stimulating muscle growth. If you're doing light loads, then you need more reps, or you're essentially just doing a warm-up. So it needs to be high effort, whether the load is heavy or you're doing more reps closer to failure. And if you're not doing high effort, then you can certainly do a ton of sets and probably get the same effect, but then you're also spending a lot of calories. You know, I look at it the same way I do with writing. You don't want the reader to spend a lot of calories understanding what you're trying to communicate. So that's, you know, the same thing with a muscle. You want it to understand that it's supposed to be growing larger and stronger by providing a sufficiently strong signal with each repetition that you're doing. That's not to say that I believe we should only be doing 5 to 8 rep sets, even though you have less fatigue simply because you're doing less overall work, exposing it to heavier loads. So you kind of ensure that you get more bang for your buck for every rep. But there are also intrinsic effects of higher reps that I think have been kind of ignored or overlooked or just dismissed. But, you know, since a muscle in isolation is just a dumb piece of meat contracting against a load and being exposed to mechanical tension, we can't also forget that it needs nutrients, it needs blood flow. It's a link in the chain, in the bioenergetic chain. So even cardiovascular training has its place in building optimal muscle mass, because eventually if you only lift heavy weights, if you're a powerlifter or a weightlifter, cardiovascular efficiencies eventually become going to become a bottleneck, you know. So you need that for intraset recovery, interset recovery, and between workout recovery. So and that's where frequency enters the picture, because we need to go in there and create a sufficient stimulus, and then we need to wait until you have recovered enough for that signal to be translated into muscle growth. And that usually only takes from 6 to 48 hours, depending on different variables and in, you know, individual context again. And the time it takes to recover from each additional set will vary from muscle group to muscle group and from individual to individual. Are you someone 20 years old, full of testosterone, living bodybuilding life, eating perfectly, going to sleep at 9 o'clock each night, you know, all your ducks are lined up perfectly, then for sure you're going to recover sooner and can thus train with a higher frequency. and more volume per workout. You know, you can get away with that. You can grow from that. And looking at the processing of a signal from lifting loads to actual muscle growth, which is quite rapid, I believe we need to try to find sort of that sweet spot where we're doing just enough, but not so much that it just prolongs recovery, so that you have to wait, you know, until a week has passed before you can actually train a muscle again, because I don't really subscribe to the idea that you're either building or you're breaking down. But there is still some truth to that. And on an individual level, we should probably try to optimize for being able to train a muscle more frequently than once per week. But for most, training a muscle 2 to 3 times per week, so every 3 to 5 days, is probably going to be where most find their best gains over time. And the problem with always trying to chase optimal instead of minimal is that we're chasing that upper bound all the time. And as soon as something is off, one night of poor sleep, poor eating, life stress, whatever is going on, it's going to affect recovery to the extent that you're going into the next workout under recovered. Mm. So whether it takes you 5 years or 10 years to reach, you have a ceiling determined by your genes and your hormones. What's the rush? I mean, are you going to be training from your 20 to 25? Then sure, you know, if you have competition plans that you're just going to win a few contests and then you're going to, you know, be a couch potato or, you know, go into endurance training for the rest of your training career. You know, for sure, chase upper bounds. But I think it's better to start at the low end and see how little it actually takes to stimulate progressive overload and find that sweet spot in volume and frequency. And it's way less than most seem to think or believe, given the current state of affairs in the training industry. And just milk that for what it's worth so that you have room to play. You know, you have room to add more if you want more over several months. And that's a much better mindset than this instant gratification, chasing the maximum recoverable volume all the time. And I see way too many just getting burnt out or injured in their 20s. I did so myself, so I'm, you know, older and wiser, hopefully, and I've kind of learned my lesson and take more of a slow and steady approach in all endeavors in life, simply because it makes the whole process more enjoyable. So again, to answer your question, both volume and frequency are important. You need to find that balance that allows you to progress, and your ability to add reps or load every time you enter the gym is a sign that you have found a good balance. And the fear of missing out, adding more to get more, is what drives people into that upper bound prematurely instead of slowly and surely getting there and perhaps systematically experimenting to see what's your lower and upper bounds. So I tend to just recommend, I'm rambling and going on here, but you know, I'm on a roll now. So, you know, if you just start at the low end and see what you get from that, then with that frequency, you start adding volume, add one more set. What happens? Did you get better, worse, or the same gains? Add one more set. And at a certain point, you will reach a point of diminishing returns where you simply, it takes some time because there's a delay, you know, fatigue will accumulate. So allow 3 to 4 weeks. And now you see, wow, you're just, you know, feeling under recovered and you're not really getting more out of more any longer. So you scale it back, you step it back, and now you start adding rest days, you lower the frequency. suddenly you see you can do more volume per workout since you have more days to recover until next time. And this will be different between muscle groups and between individuals, obviously. And by systematically doing this, over the next year or two, having a data-oriented approach, we just look at the numbers, try to take your emotions out of it, which is the hard part. Then you will see, okay, within this frequency and volume range on the lower end and this volume and frequency at the upper end, I have my best gains. So I can just play around with this and apply it perhaps differently to different muscle groups and make adjustments on the fly because I know I'm still within that range. So it's not this one perfect number for everyone always. It's going to be, it's an organic process. And the same way last year's sun exposure to your skin will determine this year's ability to handle sunlight. That's the way it is with training as well. So it's going to be moving back and forth as you get older and more experienced and able to lift heavier loads and apply effort in the gym while also obviously making sure that you have the nutrition and sleep and stress management in place. So I like to periodize according to life stress. If your life is a mess right now, then you should probably scale down your training because you can't expect to have the same gains. You simply have less energy to direct into your training and recovery, and vice versa. If you're on vacation, if you know everything is good in life and you're sleeping well and recovering well, for sure try to push volume a little and frequency even. So that's a long way to answer a simple question, but these things have complexity.
Definitely. What an answer. Yeah, I think there's people love to look at the acute response as opposed to what happens over a longer period of time. So I had a conversation with protein and muscle protein synthesis with Dr. Jose Antonio, and he was saying to me that people are looking too much into how much protein can I have in one specific meal. It's your daily protein intake is what matters, but besides that point, why I'm bringing it, how I'm making it relevant to this conversation is that he's saying, what can you do over a longer period of time? You don't have to go just have this massive bolus of protein. Just make sure you can get enough in a day as opposed to just going and making yourself ill, or it's just not achievable. You have to make sure it's realistic. It's like when someone goes to the gym for the first time, or they go for a run for the first time, it's probably a better analogy, and then run 5K as fast as they can. And they're just like, Jesus, is that what I need to do to lose some weight? And they never do it again. So. Slow and steady wins the race. As you're saying, carry on.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. And you actually see the same thing in endurance. You know, people chasing optimal and doing intervals, this and that, and just, you know, getting injured or burned out. I'm on this private forum of this physiologist, Alan Cousins, who's, you know, specialized in Ironman training and, you know, he's been working in multiple disciplines throughout the years. And he says, you know, one of the most overrated tools is interval training. Most will actually get the best gains by just building their zone one. And that's so easy to many that it feels almost as if they're not really training. But the point is that while it's still training, it's still a stimulus, and you can do it for hours and hours. And that's what's going to be sustainable, what you're going to be looking forward to do instead of, oh my God, another, you know, 10-minute interval session with Tabatas. You know, I'm going to be sick going into that workout every single time, and eventually you're going to stop doing it because it's not sustainable.
Exactly. You don't realize when it comes in terms of that topic, but yeah, mitochondrial biogenesis, all that kind of stuff is what you're looking at there. So, just obviously still working with a little bit of volume and frequency. I just wanted to ask, you've obviously mentioned about some sort of fatigue. There's some sort of metabolites people talk about potentially having an effect on hypertrophy. And then the lower the rep ranges, the lower the metabolite accumulation, theoretically speaking. I might be wrong about that. And then the higher reps, the more calories, like you're saying, you're burning off. But then is there also a higher amount of rep ranges with that? And then, so my question basically is, which one of those is probably best? Like you're saying, obviously, like legs are high type 1 muscle fibers, so probably going to recover a little bit quicker, so it could probably handle a bit more volume. Is that going to be more volume in terms of rep ranges or as in frequency? And then is there any argument for either side for maybe tendon stiffness as well?
Yeah, good question. I mean, you could, from a type efficiency standpoint, say that 5 to 8 reps is going to probably be the sweet spot. It is going to be less metabolically stressing and perception of effort. I also think over time it's going to be limiting. We have plenty of real world case studies of this. I posted it on my Instagram. Some of the, you know, top bench press specialists, Josef Eriksson in Sweden and Jesus Varela in Spain, figured out at some point in their career that just doing powerlifting training just got them stuck. You know, they kept running into a wall and getting injured, and because, you know, heavy loads take their toll on connected tissue and joints. Let's not forget about that. And they started introducing higher up training, so 20 to 30 reps. And within a year, their bench press had just taken off. And like Josef told me in private conversation, he's not the best bench presser in Sweden anymore because he taught his methods to hundreds of people. And many of them have surpassed him. So he's using that model of low rep training, targeted low rep training, but also spending probably 80% of a training cycle just focusing on getting stronger in high rep ranges and then peaking to, you know, top end strength. Some element of heavy training is sustained throughout the training cycle, but it's a less percentage of the total training than ever before. So we can't discount this by looking at isolated short-term studies on some target populations that may not be representative or never are representative of dedicated lifters that have been doing this for many, many years and just want to break a plateau or get, you know, further in their training career. Then we need to look at how many tools do we have available. So there's no best anything. There's different tools for different jobs. And if you only be doing, you know, if everything you have is a hammer, then everything looks like a nail is, you know, a good metaphor for this. But you will get to a point where you need a Phillips head screwdriver, because the hammer won't drive a screw into a wall. You need something that's, you know, the best tool for the job. So again, bottlenecks in the bioenergetic chain, you will run into weak links in the chain that limit your overall progress. And higher up training and the metabolic stress and, you know, whether it's lactate or whatever, even if it's indirect, you need blood flow, capillarization. You need cardiovascular conditioning, strength, endurance, adaptations. You need fatigue, resistance as well. You know, if you just have this paranoid fear of fatigue, the only way to get stronger in life is to willingly expose yourself to a stress, even if it's a tough stress. If you just stay in the comfort zone all the time, then you're not going to keep growing. So I think we need to also use, you know, a periodized strategy, or just look at what have you been doing for a while. And if you're stuck, perhaps it's time to introduce another rep range, another progression strategy, scale up or down volume or frequency, switch out some exercises, see what's a potential weakness for you. Because as soon as you make that weakness a strong point, then it will strengthen the whole game. So that's why I think that they all have their place. And it's going to be just a narrow snapshot in time where I you know, we can say with a higher degree of certainty that this tool will be the best tool for that specific job right now, but it's not going to be for everyone always.
Just a quick break. If you find this information useful, please like, subscribe, and send this to a friend. Otherwise, let's get back to the conversation.
Yeah, and I think communicating that with, let's say someone would have a coach, communicating that kind of concept with a coach whereby something's not really working with them. Because at the end of the day, I think also a certain mindset has a massive part to play. So if you don't like the lower rep ranges, you're not going to want to perform that. It's like someone saying to me, I've got clients who absolutely hate doing walking lunges and I don't blame them. And I know now if I program those walking lunges, they just won't do them. These are things I think that people tend to forget about. Exercise is not just about just building a load of muscle unless you're a professional bodybuilder. It's about making everything stronger, fitter, bones more dense, your stress starts to be alleviated. So you need to make sure we do something that is enjoyable, because emphasizing mindset is obviously important. So now, when it comes to the metabolite side of things, do you really think that it has such a profound effect having an increase in, like I've heard certain people speak about things like hydrogen ions and calcium ions. I'm talking about, so I heard the conversation with Samuel Butner, and it was fascinating, especially the pizza analogy. I absolutely love it. And I listened to some others. I'm not going to mention today, but it just gave me a different perspective of things. And I was just wondering if those metabolites actually do have such a profound effect that it's going to have a massive effect on things like supraspinal central nervous system fatigue. Is it going to affect your next day? Is it going to affect your following workouts? Is there anything you'd like to elaborate on the metabolite side of things?
I think the fatigue perspective, again, has been sort of overblown, and we've become paranoid of anything that's fatiguing. But let's not forget that, you know, adaptation and fatigue are two sides of the same coin. So it's we should manage it, but we can't avoid it or eliminate it. I think that would be a mistake. I think that would be throwing the proverbial baby out with the bathwater. Fatigue resistance is, you know, the same way skin resistance is part of the tanning process. You know, to avoid getting skin cancer, we need some protection in the skin. So the repeated bout effect is a necessary byproduct of the training process. The muscle gets more resistant to fatigue and training in general, and thus allows you to apply more stimulus and fatigue over time. So metabolites have indirect effects. They will enhance motor recruitment. There are even some lines of evidence suggesting they have play an indirect role in anabolic signaling. Even though you can bathe a muscle in lactate and it's not going to improve anabolism, you know, if you set up an experiment like that, and certainly, you know, blood flow restriction research has provided some more pieces to the puzzle, but we still see quite robust growth from blood flow restriction training, and they're training up to twice per day, and it should, according to what some people are saying, well, there's such a massive fatigue from high reps and metabolic stress that we should avoid it completely, and yet people are recovering and growing and progressing just fine with up to daily high volumes of blood flow restriction training. So let's look at outcomes. You can critique anything from a mechanistic understanding and say, well, this or that generates fatigue. Fatigue is bad. Therefore, we shouldn't be doing it. But then the same thing with the higher up training. Well, if the real world outcomes show that you introduce this to advanced lifters and they break through plateaus, then perhaps it was a fatigue and metabolic stress component that person actually needed to further stimulate the muscle to grow because the heavy loads weren't doing it. So I think, you know, we're ignoring it at our own peril. Looking isolated at short-term studies and, you know, the fatigue literature is telling us, you know, giving us this complete picture of the whole process, and now suddenly physiology should change arenas completely, and we should all just be doing lower rep training every other day. Training is such an old concept. I mean, we have been building muscle and knowing about bodybuilding since gladiators, and it's been like some surging in popularity since Reg Park and these well-known old timers, 30s, 40s, and 50s strongmen before steroids entered the picture, and they've been training a certain way. But you know, even though full body training was and high frequency training was very common back then, you will also see these some of these lifters doing insane volumes. Like, look at Bill Pearl. He was training every day, and he was doing full body every other day. But in between the full body workouts, he was adding tons of volume for his arms and for his legs and whatever. And they were recovering and growing just fine. So the body is such an amazing adaptable organism that we shouldn't look at it like this fragile fatigue victim that you should just protect at all costs and never do volume, never apply volume, never do high reps, never do this or that. It's this dichotomous thinking that it makes me go insane. You know, why people can't we instead try to, you know, further our common understanding and speak on a platform where there's discourse, intellectual discourse and openness, instead of huge egos waving flags and saying, hey, look at me, I know the truth. Everyone else are just, you know, liars or dumb idiots. I think it's a weird time. And I've been doing this, like I said, for 30 years, and I've seen high reps and low rep hypes come and go, high and low frequency waves come and go. What's old is new again. I mean, I started my training career with serious growth and Bulgarian burst training, which was high frequency, but probably too much volume. So I ended up horribly overtrained. I gravitated towards hypertrophy-specific training, HST, by Brian Haycock, spent many years on that. Discussion forum, had some of the best gains of my life. But I've done upper lower splits and even push pull legs and even bro splits. And I've gotten good gains on all of these at certain times in my training career. I've explored higher volumes, and I'm just sitting here today and thinking, well, there's such a wide range of possibilities. So the incessant chase for optimalism forgets that training should be fun. You should have an enjoyment training and be more playful with it, and probably also more data driven and looking at your own individual response to training and how it can actually also change over time according to what you're doing and within the context of your psychology and overall stress levels and perception of yourself and the world around you and like the sum of stressors in your life, instead of this myopic tunnel vision on details. So that's my mic drop for the day, I guess.
Yeah, so exactly why I wanted to bring you on. The amount of people in the science-based community who like to, I'll be honest with you, just attack each other. And from someone who watches these people from all sides, if I'm honest, it comes a little bit, It's just demoralizing, if I'm honest. And it just looks childish. And I just hope that people can be scientists and actually have a discussion. Samuel Buckner has commented on things before, and people start arguing with him, and he goes, this isn't a debate. This is a conversation. And I completely agree with that, obviously. And I think hopefully the fitness industry can move in the right directions where we can have more conversations. So you've obviously been talking about how you've been talking about how.
Sorry, my camera died. So.
Oh, it's okay. No problem.
Yeah.
So we've discussed how you've done tried out push pull legs. You've done bro splits, etc. And sometimes you've gotten to a point where fatigue has just overcome you, and then all of a sudden you've just had to reduce that. So now obviously there's some people out there who are wondering, when I get to that point, do I need to deload, or is deload not actually necessary, or is deload a product of obviously your fatigue? So if I deload and go back to the same program, is that a smart idea, or is that just you having to do a deload with involuntarily? Is that a sign that maybe you're doing too much volume before?
Yeah, I think so. I think deloading is damage control. And it should be a reactive thing, or preferably proactive. But then again, sometimes it needs to be reactive. So if you're not progressing, then you're by definition not recovered from last time. So perhaps you should do less volume and more reps in reserve for that workout, so that you have a higher chance to come back stronger the next time, and even add another rest day to make sure you're sleeping well. So programming deloads to me means that you are of the belief that you should be getting sunburns to get an optimal suntan. And to me, that doesn't make any sense. You know, you should be figuring out the sweet spot for stimulus that's neither too high or too low, and stay within that range so that you can tolerate. You know, you should be planning for your worst days, essentially. What's the lower and upper bounds? Because life isn't optimal. Optimal meets perfect all the time. So if you plan for the worst days, what's the minimum you can do? Then do that. If you're going through a period of time where you're simply not recovering, or you have too many life stressors, and be happy with it. I mean, I have so many clients that are just driving themselves insane because they think that they need to be hitting optimal all the time, or it's not worth doing. And I just tell them, well, go in, do one set, go home, and perhaps do the same thing 5 days later. You know, you can maintain really well just doing one set every once in a while. And they do that, and they actually become stronger because they're, you know, obviously under-recovered. Mm-hmm. And see that, you know, the worst days, lowest threshold, can at worst maintain and potentially be the best thing for you right now. So that once everything is lined up again, now you have room to go back to the sweet spot. So that's just, again, deloads shouldn't be, I'm just going to go hard for 6 weeks and go easy for 3 weeks or 1 week or whatever. That means, you know, why should you be going hard for 6 weeks if that's just too much for you? Slow and steady again. You know, 1% every day is 36 times in a year, according to James Clear. So I think we should adopt the same mindset when it comes to our training process.
Yeah. What a book, right?
Yeah. Amazing. Universal concepts.
Absolutely. So I know I keep bringing up things like fatigue and rest periods and all this jazz, because I think these are things that people very much get confused with, and especially around hypertrophy in the fitness industry. And then there's drop sets, supersets, rest periods between sets. Can you maybe elaborate on that? Are drop sets necessary? Are supersets, obviously you came up with the Myo reps, is there a specific amount of rest period that is minimal or optimal even between sets? And if you can elaborate on maybe some of that.
Yeah, it's the interaction again that we have between volume and frequency. It's the same thing with respires and effort. So we have studies showing that rest pause and drops of training are more effective than traditional. And simply because the metabolic stress and the short rest periods increases indirectly or even directly the effort level for that person. So especially in the elderly and people who are more, you know, scared of pushing themselves, it's a safer way to push them into higher effort levels. And we see that, yeah, that tends to improve their gains simply because it, you know, it's to them a safe way to push themselves instead of you're going into the gym now and doing your 5 rep max and doing that for 5 sets, you know, and we're going to do that Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And to many, that's a scary thought and they hold back, whether they want to or not. So short rest periods, I believe, have their place. And we have rest pause research showing that it's, it can be more fatiguing if you take every set to failure, which is why I've been emphasizing managing fatigue and staying 1 to 2 reps in reserve throughout, because it allows you more stimulus in less time. So it's a very time efficient way to train. And again, looking at real world outcomes, comparatively speaking, 1 Y rep set is the same as 3 to 4 traditional sets, but it takes 70% less time. And, you know, the study from Tampa that we're all been waiting for 2 years now to be published shows that it provides the same gains. It's the same results. If it was that fatiguing, then people wouldn't be making gains. They would be burnt out by the end of the study, yet they repeated the study twice in different semesters with different subject pools, and it showed the same thing. And they have done so for many, many years. And for many, it's been the game changer. It's been the one thing that provided the best gains of their life, simply because the traditional way of training with long rest periods and probably not pushing themselves hard enough was the limiter. So it's a way to make sure that increasing your effort and also the indirect effects of better work capacity, better cardiovascular conditioning. I think, you know, doing high rep short rest period training has a place in the training journey, because it's a way to apply the volume, but in a quick and efficient manner, and it builds capacity. It shouldn't be the only way to train, for sure. So periodizing it, going from that type of training to heavier low rep training with long rest periods, that will take care of the more strength, you know, high stimulus to fatigue ratio end of the spectrum. And then perhaps, you know, go back to high rep training again. So you either in the same workout, the same training week, or within a 10 to 12 week training phase, I believe that's a good way to look at the overall process. And like you said earlier, I have clients that just hate anything below 10 reps. And it doesn't matter. You can show them all the research in the world. If every time they're told to do 8 reps, they hate going to the gym, then that's not sustainable. I've had clients doing exclusively 15 rep programs. And they've been gaining like crazy. And they used to be, that particular woman I'm thinking of used to be doing a five sets of five program with her boyfriend, and he was gaining like crazy on that, and she was getting nowhere. And once I allowed her, you know, I told her, well, do 15 reps if you enjoy that. She loved it, and she had better gains than her boyfriend. So we can't take the psychology out of it. It's or the physiology and understanding of the bottlenecks and the chain of events, you know, the overall physiology, so many different links that we kind of need to see if there are any bottlenecks that needs to be strengthened. So I know the meta reviews are showing that we should probably be resting 2 to 3 minutes to get the most bang for our buck, the best stimulus on subsequent sets. But sometimes you just need one RM set and you go home or you do another muscle group. And that's going to be a very effective workout for you. I've had clients with some crazy gains doing that exclusively, 2 full body workouts per week in a busy life where their family time and work are more important to them. And that was just way more effective than spending 2 hours at the gym 4 times per week from both a time and efficiency and energetic perspective.
Absolutely. Absolutely awesome. And I love that with the MyReps, like just as much gains in 70% less time. Like what a statement that is, right? And to be the person who created that is quite a cap on, that's for sure. So just my last question, I know obviously I do genuinely respect your time. I just wanted to know, because a lot of people do ask me this from a coaching perspective. Let's say one muscle group is lagging compared to the other. What is your approach? Do you believe in doing unilateral exercise of that specific movement in the beginning, because that's when you're least fatigued, or maybe towards the end of a session, for whatever reason? If you can just explain that, and then that'll be all my questions.
Yeah, I think it's multifactorial. Sometimes low responders need more volume, and that probably goes for certain muscle groups as well. If you're not able to recruit that muscle group in a compound lift like me with, you know, pecs in the bench press, then dedicating isolation exercises to that muscle group for a period of time will make it start catch up and start to contribute in the compound lifts. So I would kind of systematically try to isolate that muscle and maybe start every workout with that muscle group and doing an isolation movement. Start with one set and build up gradually. For me, volume didn't work for chest, so I was doing way too much volume on pressing exercises, doing just 1 or 2 sets and allowing that muscle to recover. So for me, pecs are optimally trained 2x per week, and it actually brought my chest up to a point where an NPC judge told me, you have quite good pecs, and you should be focusing on your lats instead. Your lats and legs are weak points. I was really happy to hear that because I thought pecs were my weak point, and it has been for years, but I managed to bring it up, and simply by understanding this physiology and systematically figuring out what provided the best progressive overload. And that for me was a lower sweet spot in volume and frequency than I used to think. But now my pecs are beginning to tolerate more volume and frequency again, so I can load it with more. But now they actually don't need as much, you know. So it's a systematic process. But I've also had clients with underdeveloped muscle groups that they probably weren't training sufficiently hard. They were subconsciously holding back. So I first start with find your actual failure point. Go do as many reps as until you physically can't move the load anymore. And some are surprised to find that they are either severely underestimating or overestimating their level of effort, meaning that some are training with more than 5 reps in reserve. So catching up that difference was the ticket to gains, while some were thinking that, yeah, I'm stopping 2 to 3 reps from failure. And they were actually training to failure every single time, so they were under recovered. So once they started to have an actual 1 to 2 rep in the reserve, their gains took off because now they are recovering between workouts. So that was, you know, the cause of their stagnation and regression. So it can be both end of the spectrum, but the only way to figure out is to begin experimenting. Be curious.
Amazing. Thank you for that. I think it's just good for people to remember as well that research does show that people who train to failure versus people that train within 1 to 2 reps in reserve do see similar hypertrophy results, except obviously you have less fatigue, right? Okay. But yeah, that's everything. Thank you so much for your time. If you can just maybe tell us a little bit about where we can find you, how we can contact you, etc., then that would be amazing, because obviously there's your channels on YouTube, there's your obviously there's your podcast as well. So if you can maybe talk about all of those areas where people can find the educational side of what you do as well, that'll be amazing.
My legacy will be my reps ebook. So go to myreps.com. That will provide you with training programs, walkthrough videos, and an invitation to a community where I post and answer questions all the time. So that would be my primary recommendations. If you know that you want coaching from me, go to my website, borgefagerli.com. Social media, kind of still figuring that out. I have the most activity on my Instagram channel. I've started posting on LinkedIn as well, but Instagram is by far where I already have a lot of free content. I do have a YouTube channel with some very interesting podcast interviews, so, you know, check that out as well. I'll probably be switching to a more pure podcast format with my overarching model, Peaceful Peak Performance, and speaking from that perspective instead of, you know, spending probably way too much time nerding about physiology and hypertrophy.
Awesome. Thank you so much. You have the respect of, I'm going to say, everyone in the industry.
I'm not so sure about that, but.
No,
but
I think.
Thank you.
I think even people who currently might have some disagreement with that deep down, they definitely respect you. So just want to say, thank you so much for your time. And best of luck with everything that you do in your career. And I'll hopefully get coaching from you one day, because sure. I think that'll probably be something.
Yeah, join my community and, you know, we'll see what we can do.
Cool. Thank you so much for your time. Look after yourself. Have a nice day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you found it useful, please share with a friend. They would also benefit from these talks. If you'd like to keep up with everything else I get up to, you can check out my Instagram at rich_performance_nutritionist and feel free to drop me a message with your thoughts and feedback on this weekly chat so far.